It's a blessing, as always, to gather together and to study the Word together. And I didn't realize, I had looked what the Sunday school lesson was about, but I didn't realize quite how much what I planned to share this morning is, it could be a continuation of the Sunday school lesson, but that's okay. It's been said that there's never been a culture with a lower pain threshold than ours, that there's never been a culture that gave us fewer resources for dealing with the brutal realities of life and death than ours. There's never been a time when people scream faster because of perceived injustices or supposed infringement of personal rights and opinions than the culture and the time that we live in now. So turn with me to Hebrews chapter 12. The writer of Hebrews wanted his readers to understand how to become the kind of people who can cope with the brutal realities of life. And sometimes it's said that chapter 12 is the climax of the book of Hebrews. And we're very familiar with the figure of speech that the New Testament writers used, comparing the Christian life to a race. And the writer here of Hebrews uses that again here in the first verses. And chapter 12 follows, of course, chapter 11, which is what we refer to as the faith chapter. Because he lists by name, I think it's 17, different men and women, faithful men and women, and then he alludes to many more that completed their races successfully against incredible odds. And he begins chapter 12 with this word, wherefore, which of course, as we know, ties back to the previous chapter. And I want to begin reading at verse 32 of chapter 11, and I'm going to read to chapter 12, verse 13. So Hebrews 11, verse 32. And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, and of Barak, and of Samson, of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down, and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. We're going to stop there, although the rest of the chapter has a lot of good messages as well. And somebody suggested that I that I preach a message on this chapter. And the more I studied, the more I realized I couldn't do it all in one. So maybe at some point we'll look at the rest of the chapter. But at this point, we're just going to look at the first half here through verse 13. But coming back to this idea of the race, let us run this race. This is the actual race. This is not a training course. This is not an event preparing for the final race. This is the actual race that he's calling us to run. And this race is not just a sprint. It's not a 100-meter dash. It's a marathon. It's an endurance race. And probably most of us don't know much about running marathons, and Dwayne could tell us a whole lot more about it than even I can. But if you've run a marathon, you know that you can't wake up one morning and go run a marathon. It takes a lot of preparation. It takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of training to prepare to run a marathon. But that's what we're in the Christian life. We're in a race. It's an endurance race. It's not about quick bursts of effort. It's steady endurance over time. It's strenuous self-sacrifice that demands lots of training and discipline. And there are clear and strict rules for this race. And in 1 Timothy 2:5, Paul wrote, "And if a man also strive for masteries, yet is he not crowned, except he strive lawfully, or unless he follows the rules." And so he doesn't win the ground if he doesn't follow the rules, if he doesn't run according to the guidelines. In April of 1980, there was a lady named Rosie Ruiz who was crowned the first woman winner of the Boston Marathon. And she ran it with a record-setting time, or her recorded time was 2 hours, 31 minutes, and 56 seconds, which was about 2.5 minutes faster than the person who came in second place. But observers were somewhat suspicious because she didn't look like a person that just ran a marathon. She wasn't all sweaty. She wasn't exhausted. She seemed pretty fresh at the end of this race, this 26.2 miles. The clothing she was wearing was not typical for a marathon winner either. And she seemed unfamiliar. She was giving, as of course they were interviewing her as the winner, she seemed unfamiliar with some of the terminology that they were using regarding training and marathons. And 8 days later, she was stripped of her title because after investigating, it became apparent that she hadn't run the whole race. She had started, and then in some fashion, she had bypassed a bunch of it and then joined the race in the last half mile, or the last mile or so, and crossed the finish line first. And then as they were investigating, they discovered that what qualified her to take part in the Boston Marathon was in 1979, she ran in the New York Marathon, and she got into that one because she claimed to have cancer, and it was her dying wish to run in a marathon, and so out of the goodness of their hearts, they left her run. And she didn't win that one, but she did finish it, and they discovered that her qualifying time in that race was because she started, and then she dipped into the subway station and rode the subway to the finish line and ran across the finish line. So she participated in two marathons, but she didn't run either one. And of course, she didn't get to claim to be the winner, although she, for the rest of her life, she refused to admit that she cheated, and she also refused to turn back in her trophy. So she held on to her trophy, but it was meaningless because she didn't run the race. And her whole life was overshadowed with that controversy, and her name has become synonymous with cheating in races, and I'm told that in blatant cheating in races is still sometimes referred to as someone pulling a Rosie Ruiz. And so she participated in the races, but she didn't get the crown because she wasn't the winner because she didn't follow the rules. She didn't run the whole race. And obviously that illustration falls short when we think about in comparison to this race of life. But it does highlight that races and the Christian life are only won by enduring the entire race and all it entails. There's no shortcuts. There's no easy way to bypass the hardships and get to the finish line. And so this race is critical. It's a life or death race, but it's not impossible. And he says, we have this great cloud of witnesses that are all around us. And sometimes, maybe you've heard this illustration used as well, they're cheering us on. You know, when you think of a race and you think of all the spectators lining the side and they're cheering us on. Well, that's not really the picture here that he's giving. The picture of this is they're witnesses and that they're examples. We have all of these people that went before us and ran the race. They completed the race successfully. They're an example that we could actually run this race too. It's not impossible to run this race. And These people endured a lot of hardships, and yet they're witnesses to us of faith and endurance. None of us have obviously been beheaded for our faith. None of us have been put in prison or even seriously mocked. None of us were cut in half. None of us were wrapped in sheepskins and thrown to the lions. None of us are hiding in mountains or caves. We're pretty public with our gathering here this morning. Those are some of the things mentioned in chapter 11 that people endured. We get more recently, in the last year, there was Christians in Africa that were locked inside a church and the church was burned. There's people today that are being beaten by their family members because they're converting to Christianity. We don't know anything about that, but there's people today that are enduring that. And they're part of this growing cloud. This cloud is continuing to grow and get bigger and bigger. And we also have faithful acquaintances. We have faithful relatives that have gone before us that are part of this cloud, that make up this cloud. They're examples. They're witnesses of faithfulness, regardless of whatever circumstances they might have faced, of enduring and running this race to victory. And so he says, considering seeing this great cloud of witnesses, run the race. So this is a call. He's giving an invitation, or even more of a challenge. He's like, let's run this race. Let's do this. John MacArthur wrote, there ought to be an aggressiveness to the Christian life. There ought to be a competitiveness to the Christian life insofar as you fight against weakness and indolence and laziness and ignorance and sin to be what God wants you to be. First of all, come to Christ. Get in the race. And when you're in it, run it. We don't need a whole lot of flaky Christians lying around the track. End quote. And so I've titled the message, Enduring Through Chastisement. Enduring Through Chastisement. And first of all, how do we run the race? He gives us several pointers here of how we run the race. First of all, we run the race as free as we can. He says there in verse 1, he says, lay aside every weight. Lay aside every weight. Cast off whatever is heavy in your life. Whatever's weighing you down, get rid of it. Remember this, he's using this analogy of running a race. They're running the race. This is not the training event, we said. This is the race. And we know that when people train and exercise, they use weights, right? And you can buy weighted vests. I saw the other day in the store, you can get a 40-pound weighted vest. And I'm thinking, imagine trying to run with a weighted vest. Some of us can barely run the way it is, put on a weighted vest yet and run. But they do that. That's part of the training process. They use weights to build up their endurance, their stamina. Baseball players, I'm told, put weights on their bats. They call them donuts. And it helps to strengthen their swing. And so when they get up to bat, they take off the donut, the weight, and then they swing like there was weight on it and it's supposed to help them swing, hit better. And I suppose it probably does. But when it comes to the real event, you don't want weight on your bat. You don't want to swing at the pitch with that donut on your bat. You don't want to run a marathon with a weighted vest on. You want to get rid of the weight. You throw off the weight. Jockeys will sometimes even vomit before they start a horse race because they're trying to get rid of every bit of weight that they can. Lay aside every weight. And those are extreme examples, but that's the point that he's making here. Anything in your life that's holding you back, and these are legitimate things. These aren't, because notice he makes another category, and we'll get to that, the sin which doth so easily beset us. These weights are legitimate things. These are things that may be not wrong in and of themselves, but if they're weighing you down and preventing you from running successfully, get rid of them. Maybe it's acquaintances or relationships that are a wrong influence in your life. Maybe it's a possession that's taking too much of your time and attention. Could be social media or news outlets. It could be a lot of different things. And if you're honest with yourself, you know what that is in your life. You know what the thing is in your life that's holding you down, that's dragging you down. Get rid of it. Throw it off. The second thing here, he says, is get rid of the sin which doth so easily beset us. What is the sin that you're most susceptible to or that you struggle the most with? And again, that might be different for each one of us. But what is the sin that clings and entangles you? Today we water down sin. We call it addictions. We have addictions. But addictions are sins that cling to us or that are sins that beset us. This word beset has the idea of clinging, holding to us. And we know how hard it is to get rid of besetting sins. They cling to us. It could be lust. It could be anger. It could be pride. It could be selfishness. Whatever it is, flesh is insatiable and will always drag us down. Psalm 119, 133. Direct my footsteps according to your word. Let no sin rule over me. That's the prayer of a faithful runner. Let no sin rule over me. Throw it off. Secondly, how do we run? We run as focused as we can. In verse 2, he says, looking unto Jesus. Looking unto Jesus. That means looking away from other things. It's the idea of a single focus. We're singly focused on Jesus. It's so easy to be distracted. We're told that about 1.6 million accidents a year happen because people are distracted with their phones. And if you're like me, you're guilty of that at times. Four out of five accidents are because people are distracted by whatever it is. But distractions in driving are deadly, and distractions in running this Christian life are deadly as well. And we can turn to Matthew chapter 14. We have an example of Peter being distracted. Matthew 14, verse 28 to 31. We know this story. Peter, they're on the boat, the storm, and Jesus comes walking on the water, and Peter says, "Is that you?" And he says, "If it is, tell me to come." And he jumped out of the boat and started towards Jesus. And we criticize Peter, or maybe we're a little hard on Peter sometimes because he started to sink. What does it say? Let me read these verses here. Verse 29, and he said, "Come, Jesus." And when Peter was come down out of the boat, out of the ship, he walked in the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said unto him, "O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" He was walking on the water. He believed that he could. Jesus said, "Come," and he went towards Jesus, but he got distracted. But what I was saying is sometimes we get a little hard on Peter for getting distracted. But he actually started. He did walk on water. That's more than the rest of us can say. What if we had the faith to get out of the boat and start walking? But it is a good example of what happens when we get distracted. He lost his focus on Jesus, and he saw what was around him, and he started to sink. Why do we focus on Jesus? He says, well, first of all, he's the author and finisher of our faith. Philippians 1:6, being confident of this very thing, that he which hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. The author, we know what the author is. The author is somebody that writes something, that produces something. We could say he's the founder of faith. He's the source of faith. Interestingly enough, this word also has the idea of captain. If you look it up in Strong's, it also has the idea of captain. And so Jesus is our team captain. He's the source of our faith. He's the captain of our faith. And he's also the finisher. He's with us at a starting line. He's with us at the finish line. And he's with us the whole way through the race that he sets before us. And like Peter, it's so easy to get distracted by the stuff around us. Maybe we get distracted by our own feelings of unworthiness. We start focusing on ourselves. We fail. Peter, he got distracted and he started to sink, right? He didn't feel sorry for himself. What did he do? He cried out to Jesus. He focused back on Jesus and said, "Lord, save me." That's what we need to do. When we do get distracted, because we will get distracted, we need to get our focus back on Jesus, off of ourselves. Get our eyes off of ourselves. Look to Jesus. It takes continual effort and choosing to do that. And then we look to Jesus because he endured the cross. He suffered incredible shame and pain for me and you. He endured so that we could have his presence and power to endure. And then we look to Jesus because he's seated at the right hand of the throne of God. We see that there in the end of verse 2. In the Bible, the right hand is always a picture of honor and strength. Seated at the right hand of God is a seat of honor, a place of honor, a place of strength. And when we look at our lives and our failures and our weaknesses, we have two choices. We can give up and sit down. We can drop out of the race. Or we can look to Jesus. We can claim his power and his position for courage and victory, and we can continue on. Number three, how do we run? We run as faithfully as we can. The end of verse 1, he says, let us run with patience, or that word could be endurance, with endurance the race that is before us. And in verse 3, he says, for consider him that endured, that's Jesus, consider Jesus that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. So we run with patience. We run with endurance. He says, think about Jesus, lest you're wearied and faint in your minds. That faint in your minds is discouraged. Lest you're wearied and discouraged. Are you feeling depressed? Consider him. Jesus endured the hostility and the hatred of his fellow men. Christianity, I believe, is the only religion that says, we serve a God that suffered for us and successfully, victoriously. And in so doing, he not only provided salvation for us, he also gave an example for us to follow. He says in verse 4, he says, you haven't suffered anywhere close to what Jesus endured. You haven't shed blood. None of us have shed blood for Jesus. He endured for the joy that was set before him. It says there in verse 2, he says, for the joy that was set before him. And so we run as faithfully as we can, following the example of Jesus, who endured for the joy that was set before him. What was that joy? That joy was us, was you and me. He already had glory and holiness. The only thing that God didn't have was us. And so he endured for us because he wanted us. He wanted that relationship with us. And so that joy that was before him was knowing that the suffering that he endured was providing a way that each of us could be in his presence. We gain courage to run faithfully when we consider what all Jesus has endured for us. And then it seems like maybe that he goes off on another tangent here in the next verses. And he changes the metaphor from using the figure of a race to using the metaphor of a family, or the example of a family, and specifically a loving father disciplining his beloved children. But remember, he's not leaving this thought of running a race. But he's saying that we're in a race. We're running a race. There's going to be obstacles. There's going to be hardships. There's going to be difficulties that come in the race. And you're going to have to continue on. And how do we do that? How do we continue? How do we endure in this race no matter what comes? God didn't create evil and suffering. In fact, God has gone to great lengths to remove evil and suffering. But he does allow hardships to draw us back to him, to allow hardships to draw us closer to him. He allows us at times to reap for our disobedience and wrong that we commit. And Timothy Keller said, your faith will never grow if it isn't tested. Your commitment will never grow unless it is threatened. Your patience will never grow unless it is taxed. Your compassion will never grow unless it is tapped. Your courage will never grow unless it is challenged. And so we face hardships in our race. And how do we endure? He uses the word here, chastisement. How do we endure chastisement in our race? That's the second main point. How do we endure chastisement in our race? Number one, remember that chastisement will come. In verse 5, he says, did you forget the exhortation that said, don't despise the chastening of the Lord or faint when thou art rebuked of him? So he says, did you forget that you're going to have hardships? And the comment was made in Sunday school that about apathy is a danger that we face because we have it so easy. And it's true, we do have it so easy. And that's one reason why it makes us more susceptible to shock and surprise when we do face hardships, because we're not used to it. We don't expect it. We've come to expect an easy road. And so we're caught off guard when difficulties come. and then we're tempted to doubt God's goodness and his love. And that's a significant part of what makes trouble so troubling, because we're shocked by it. We somehow didn't think that we were going to have a hardship, and so we're shocked by it when it comes. In verse 6, he says, he's continuing this idea of, he says, did you forget that whom the Lord loves, he chastens? Don't forget that whom God loves, he disciplines. God is never the author of evil, we said, but he does allow evil to happen sometimes. Chastisement is not always reaping for wrongdoing. The word chastisement here has the idea of to educate or discipline. And so sometimes God allows difficulties in our lives to draw us closer to him or to help teach us greater dependence on him. And so when we face difficulty, or maybe we see somebody else facing difficulty, don't assume that they're being punished for something or that you're being punished for something. If you face difficulty, ask what God's trying to teach you, but it might not mean necessarily that there's something wrong in your life. Maybe God is just trying to teach you something. God allows chastisement for purposes, and don't be surprised when it does come. Number two, remember that chastisement is a sign of sonship and love. In verses 7 and 8, he says, if you endure chastening, it's just God dealing with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the father chasteneth not? If you're not chastened, well then how can you claim to be a son, he says. And so God deals with us as sons, or we could say as children, because he loves and cares for us. Why do you discipline your children? Well, because you love them. And you know that if they continue that wrongdoing they're doing, it's going to harm them later in life. And so you want to help them learn not to do it. And if you take the logic that he's using here, if you don't correct wrongdoing, you actually hate your child. And as fathers, we're far from perfect. And so he's using this example of fathers, Chase. And we know that as fathers, we're far from perfect. We make mistakes in our disciplining of our families. We've needed to apologize for reacting in anger. Or maybe we fail to act because of ignorance or lack of initiative. And in verse 10 here, he says, these earthly fathers, for a few days they chastened us, for a little bit of time, after their own pleasure. And that's not because they enjoy doing it. That's not what that means there. It means as best they can, or to the best of their knowledge. Our fathers disciplined us as best as they knew how, is what he's saying there. But God's doing it for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. So hardships should be signposts along our race course, pointing us to God's fatherly care and giving us courage to continue moving forward. Number three, we look to the result of chastening rather than the chastening itself. In verse 11, he says, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Chastening is never pleasant. It's painful. Hardship is never something we enjoy or we look forward to. And if the purpose of our life is your own pleasure and your own comfort and your own happiness now, when troubles come, you're going to focus on the trouble. You're going to look at your circumstances and you're going to feel sorry for yourself. And that's going to bring out the worst in us. And if that's your focus, the difficulties will be insurmountable because you're trying to get over them by yourself. And we're tempted to say, well, if I can't see any good, then there mustn't be any good in it. But we have to remember that it's God's good, it's not ours. Our perspective is dark and discouraging. God's is overwhelmingly positive. And so look to the result. Ask God what he's trying to teach you. And he says that here. He says, no chastening seems to be joyous, but he says, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. That word exercise is the idea of training or benefited by it. So basically what he's saying here is, if we allow it to benefit us, it's going to yield the peaceable fruit of righteousness in our lives. In Jesus' suffering, we said, we have the example of Jesus and his suffering. In Jesus' suffering, he was seeking us. Now he says, in your suffering, seek me. Because suffering is God's way of getting his greatness and glory into our souls. And if you can't see this and accept this, you're not going to be able to run the race successfully. We always have a choice how we're going to respond to hardships in life. We can accept it and become better and ask God to teach us the lesson he's trying to teach, or we can fight it and become bitter. Job 5:17 says, "Behold, happy is the man whom God correcteth. Therefore despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty." Happy is the man whom God correcteth. Not happy because he's enduring hardships. Not happy because he faces hardships, but he's happy because he looks to the result of the chastisement. And he recognizes that this is a sign of God's love in my life. And God is trying to, is allowing me to face this to make me better and to make me more like him. And when that's our focus, we can be happy and not despise the chastening of the Almighty. Don't just despise it. Let it accomplish what God wants in our lives. Romans 8:18, he writes, "For I reckon, or I consider, that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us." Our sufferings are temporary. They're not lasting. They're temporary. And they can't be compared to the glory that shall be revealed in us. And then the last two verses that we read here, verses 12 and 13. Basically, he says, "I've told you all of this. Wherefore, because of all of this, take courage. Be strong. Lift up your hands. Get going. If you're faltering by the way, take a second breath. Look to Jesus and proceed forward. Make a straight path." And he's quoting here from Isaiah 35, verses 3 and 4. And those verses, the strength in the weak hands and the feeble knees. But then verse 4, which is not specifically called out here, I want to read that. He says, Isaiah 35, 3 and 4, "Strengthen ye the weak hands and confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. For behold, your God will come with vengeance, even God with recompense, he will come and save you." And so, take courage. Lift up the hands. If you're facing hardship, the one that allows the hardship also gives courage to endure the hardship. And so, lay aside every weight as we're running this race. Throw off whatever might be weighing you down or causing you to sit down on the sideline. Take heart. Look to Jesus. Embrace his love in whatever way he chooses to display it to you this week. And endure whatever God has for you. Let's pray.